The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me again this week is James Batchelor. Batch, how are you?
I'm okay. Again, it sounds so painful for you, doesn't it? That I've appeared again on the podcast, but
listeners, I mean, I could go on. Anyway, lovely to have you. Well, so I'm going to ask again this week. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to this week? Well, it's been a generally quiet week, but I had a quick trip to Germany to drive the new facelifted Audi A3 and the S3, which has had a power upgrade and a trick new rear differential. That's the highlight of the changes, really. And there's nothing really else to say apart from the fact that Munich was very nice at this time of year. So, yes. God. Top tip.
Did you drive that one that sort of looks like a Rover Streetwise?
Yes.
We're not getting. There's a jacked up one with plastic bits, isn't there?
Yes. Now, I didn't know this, but there is a new version called the All Street.
Is that what it's called? Oh my God.
The All Street. It's all one word with a capital S in the middle. So it's all one word. And they've dropped the City Carver name. I don't know if you remember, but there was a version of the Audi A1 that was called the City Carver.
Yes.
It was lightly jacked up with lots of plastic cladding on it. Well, that's what they've done with the A3, but they've now called it the All Street. I asked Audi UK why we're not taking it in this country. And they said, well, they're having a range rationalization. So they're slimming down their product range. And this involves not only does it mean we're not going to be getting the A3 All Street, but we're not going to be getting the A5 Coupe anymore, the A5 convertible, a whole number of cars which we're not getting in the future. And the A3 All Street is one of them, which I have to say, I'm surprised, because of course this whole SUV trend, you would think it would be a surefire winner for them. And it drives really nicely. It's 30 mil higher than the normal A3, and consequently it rides properly. But
very nice. I can't talk about the A5, actually.
I can't talk about the A3 and the S3 because it is under embargo, but
okay.
Hopefully I'm not breaking the embargo by talking about the A3 All Street because we're not getting it. So,
well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Small VW Group Product Line Podcast. So I'm going to introduce our guest now. And our guest this week joins us from our own company. We've prized him away from the news desk. It's staff writer Jack Williams. Jack, thank you for joining us today. I know we're slightly terrifying, and I definitely won't be picking all of your stories through this so that you pick me as the winner.
Oh, that will get you absolutely nowhere, of course. No, thanks for having me on. Looking forward to it.
No worries. That's, what have you been up
that's
to?
That's a lie, not isn't it?
You've got to be polite. Bloody hell, Batch.
No, Batch doesn't really do politeness. What have you been up to this week?
This week, fairly busy, as Batch says. Write a few stories for the website. I've had very similar weeks to him. Other than going to Germany and driving plastic cars, I've been on the sunny south coast all week.
Sounds delightful. No one's going to ask me how my week was.
How's your week, John?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Batch. Well, it started off with me driving to Gosport to drive a van that James has bought. He's definitely listening to this from his sofa. A van that he's bought, which doesn't work properly, to somewhere to make it work properly. And then I went to Guildford to collect two cars that he bought to sell while he's still recuperating. Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing how this operation of his keeps running while he's on his deathbed, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Deathbed. Do you know something that we don't?
Oh, was on. Sorry. Apologies to Mr. Baggett there.
No, he's definitely not on his deathbed. Just to put that out there for clarity.
So John, how are you enjoying this new life of wearing a high-vis jacket, a clipboard, and walking around with a rucksack? And of course, your glasses on top of your head, which of course all delivery drivers do.
Well, if you know anything about me, Batch, and I'm going to put my sunglasses on top of my head now, that is constantly how I look anyway. Yes. So it's not really a problem. Well, do you know what? It's quite enjoyable to actually drive some stuff that is, and this is going to sound very tiny violin, isn't it? But it's quite enjoyable to drive some stuff that isn't brand new. Like today, like whenever it was yesterday, I drove a lovely 2011 Nissan Note 1.6 automatic.
It's all glamour in this job, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
I remember driving one of those when they were brand new.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, I can't believe that this is what Nissan was making 12 years ago. Like, it's just so old-fashioned and so, like, proper old-school automatic. And then after that was a Fiat 500 1.2 Dual Logic automatic, which is
the worst
automatic gearbox I've ever come across.
I'll start that again.
It's a very nice automatic gearbox available for sale at a car collection. It's weird getting in an older car, even though they're not really that old. We are spoiled, aren't we? I mean, obviously, I know you have your ancient thing in a garage, Batch, but we are spoiled driving new things.
We are. Yes. New cars turning up all the time. We haven't got a clue, have we, really?
No, not really. Well, shall I get us into our stories then?
Please do.
Okay, so Batch and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week. And at the end, Jack gets to decide which one of us chose the best stories and who is the winner.
Can I just interrupt? Just a message for Jack here. Depending on who the winner is, will obviously dictate how the rest of his day goes in terms of workload. So just be careful.
Of course, okay? Right, okay.
Yes, a message from your senior editor there. Moving on. So I won last week, so I am going to go first. What am I going to choose? Okay, I'm going to start with Peter Waddell. So there's been a bit more of an update on the Peter Waddell Big Motoring World saga. Just to remind everyone, he appeared on the live stage at our conference last month, and then literally the next day, it was slightly confusingly announced that he was taking a leave of absence from the company. At least that's what the company said. Peter himself had very different ideas. Since then, it's all been a bit interesting. And it's culminated in, on Wednesday, the company has updated their company's house listing to say, well, Peter Waddell's been removed as the director from the holding company that owns Big Motoring World, which is Bapchild Motoring World Kent Limited. So he's now disappeared as a director. A spokesperson from Big Motoring World has told us, we confirm that Peter has left the board of Big Motoring World. Peter does not seem too happy about this, unsurprisingly. And what he's told us is that he's planning to sue. So he says, I own 62% of the business. We will be taking Fresh Stream to the High Court and we will let the judge decide. They are trying to take my company away from me. It's robbery. I have built this business up over 40 years and it's robbery. So we've also approached Fresh Stream for comment, but they haven't provided anything as of yet apart from the... Well, in fact, no, that was from Big Motoring World on my initial comment. So all is not particularly well in the Big Motoring World zone.
World.
Big Motoring World. Yeah, that's really me. yes. So, I mean, obviously we should say he's been removed as a director. He still owns 60-something percent of the company, as he said.
62%
of the business. That hasn't changed. But whether there's a clause in his contract or whatever that allows Fresh Stream to change the CEO of the company and remove him as a director if they see fit, I suppose it will all come out in the wash. We don't have access to these sorts of publications, unfortunately. But Fresh Stream, or whoever has unseated him, seems to be relatively confident that they can do it. And yeah, I suppose if he's aiming to take it to court, that's what will happen.
Yes, I think possibly from now onwards, our hands are a little bit tied in how we can report this story, because we're just going to have to wait and see what actually happens, whether it actually does go to the High Court or not. We'll have to wait and see. But, you know, I was the one covering this story. And, you know, as you do, you go to the various parties for comment. And I went to Peter for comment. And, you know, I was half expecting him just to sort of not say anything, because it is a legal matter. Well, potentially a legal matter. But he was very willing to talk to us about it. And he came out with that that quote that he thinks it's robbery and he's going to fight it. And his entire passion for what he does really came out. And, you know, it doesn't matter how you look at this. You know, this man has been hugely successful. And he has a passion for wheeling and dealing and retailing, and call it what you will, but he's got a passion for the motor trade. And so it is sad to hear, you know, the last time I spoke to him was at Car Dealer Live, and he was talking about his life history. And then the next time I'm talking to him, he's been kicked off the board of the company. So, but interestingly, I did go on LinkedIn, because we put all of our stories and all of our social channels, and he'd left a comment on the Car Dealer magazine post about this story, and just reiterated saying he will take it to court. He's going to fight this. It's his company. You know, he started it, and it's unfair. And there was quite a lot of outpouring of support from other people within the industry saying, look, it's your baby, and this is unfair, and you've got to fight it. So, yeah, it was an interesting start to Wednesday, I have to say, because we saw it very early doors, and we were on the case very quickly. So yes, it's not a nice thing to report, really.
No, sorry, Jack, go on.
It's just an interesting one. He's clearly he's a larger than life character, isn't he? To put it mildly, and we saw firsthand at Car Dealer Live, he's not afraid of being a tad controversial. But that doesn't change the fact that he's built that company from the ground, and as you say, it's his baby, and it's very sad to see.
Yeah, and I mean, and on stage at Car Dealer Live, he was sort of talking about the future a little bit, wasn't he? And saying, I can't remember his exact words, but he doesn't want to be doing this for forever and ever, does he? I think he was looking to when he was going to hang up his boots, so to speak. But this is not the ending you want, is it?
I think he said, don't take on a partner. I think he's living by that now, isn't he?
That's right, yeah. And we sort of assumed he was talking about his partner in the Cars Am days, but... Okay, your turn, Batch.
Okay, well, let's move on to Lotus then, shall we? So their accounts for last year have come out. Of course, they've only been on the NASDAQ for a short while. But they published their accounts for last year this week. And it does make for some interesting reading, I have to say. So let's start off with the good then. So Lotus managed to sell just under 7,000 cars worldwide last year, which is a new record for the company. I mean, Lotus has never sold that many cars. And the extraordinary thing about this is they are very, very confident that they're going to be able to grow this year from 7,000 cars to 26,000 cars worldwide, which is amazing. They're going to be doing this. Obviously, there's more models coming out. They're expanding to new markets. They're also expanding their dealerships. They hope to open a further 46 stores, taking the total to 215. They've got some high hopes. The problem, which we shall now move on to, is the amount of money they've brought in. So of those 7,000 cars they sold last year, 63% were pure electric. So that's the Electra SUV. So 63% of their sales are of an electric model, which sounds...
63% are of one model as well.
Yeah, which I mean, some of that might be the new electric four-door, but I think that's only been on sale very, very recently. So you can only assume that this is all the pure electric SUV. They made a revenue was £537 million. However, their net loss was £593 million. So you can't entirely lay the blame to this for their electric cars, because of course they've been expanding more dealerships, bigger facilities of their factory. All of this stuff is in that melting pot of money. But you can't help but think it does show the extreme cost of developing electric cars. Now, of course, Lotus is part of Geely. You know, a lot of the costs are associated and spread out across the company. But as we've seen with Polestar recently, Geely is very keen on making their separate car brands stand on their own two feet. So it does seem as though Lotus has really spent a lot of money on this pure electric car platform. And you can't help but think it's going to take a very long time for them to turn a profit, because, you know, a net loss of £593 million and you're expecting to grow again this year and the year on after that. It does seem there's going to be some tough days ahead of Lotus, really. Exciting days, new products and what have you. But I think they're going to be burning through some more cash reserves in the next few years, that's for sure.
I suppose Geely are hoping this will become a sort of like Bentley-ish. Well, not Bentley in terms of, well, I say not in terms of luxury, but if you look at that SUV, I don't know about the saloon, it's very plush, isn't it? It's very, very high end. I mean, it's got a lot of, it's also very Chinese car-ish in that I'm looking at a photo of it now and I can see there are bits on the wheel arches, whereas I recall LiDAR sensors pop out of the side of the car. Mm. I think there's one in the roof. It's very technology heavy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what I guess they're trying to emulate is low-ish volume, high profit margin, which is what Bentley and Rolls-Royce are.
Yes,
extremely absolutely. Good at. I couldn't tell you how long it took Rolls-Royce and Bentley to become as profitable as they are now. But they have the benefit of, apart from the engines and so on, they have the benefit of go-to platforms. They can just, you know, they've shared the development costs with VW Group, haven't they? The biggest selling Bentley is probably, I guess, the Bentayga, which is an Audi Q7 underneath, and lots of the interior bits are Audi Q7 and the engines are Audi Q7 or Porsche Cayenne or whatever for the most part. So there's, and I think the factory it's made in is, okay, there's some finishing somewhere in the UK, isn't there? But majoritatively, it's made in a VW Group factory somewhere. They don't really, there's not a Geely somewhere that looks the same as this Electra or whatever it's called, is there? It's sort of on its own a little bit. So
yeah,
I guess that's where all this cost has gone. They haven't been able to spread it out and share it across other marks.
No, you're totally right. And also, we've got to remember that the Electra and the four-door saloon that's now with us, you know, there's going to be a whole wave of Lotus cars which are not built in the UK. Mm. They're built in China. And whilst the Electra, you know, I have seen a few Electras on the roads in the UK, and it does seem to be, interest here.
I've seen two. One in Gosport, bizarrely, in bright yellow.
Good Lord. So whilst there does seem to be a bit of interest in those kinds of Lotus models in the UK, these cars primarily are for a global audience, and probably for a lot of markets which they've heard of Lotus, they know the Lotus brand, but they're probably not quite so fastidiously absolutely hell-bent on the idea that a Lotus has to be, you know, a really, really lightweight two-seater sports car. Whereas in Britain, we sort of really do hold that dear, don't we? Mm. So I think the prospects for Lotus are good, in the sense that, the Electra, I haven't driven it yet, but I have had a good look around it. It does look to be an incredibly impressive piece of kit, really. And I think they will sell a lot of these cars that are, you know, the future products, but I think it's going to be painful for Lotus.
Maybe it's just being in the UK, but I don't feel like it's had a whole amount of marketing or publicity or anything like that, really. Because I remember seeing, if I think when I saw one of these in flesh for the first time, it was at the Brussels Motor Show 2 years ago. And I haven't seen a whole lot of them since then. And I sort of think, well, I don't know what the dealer situation is like. Well, would you want to be a Lotus dealer with that current portfolio of products in the UK as well? That's not a, that big SUV is not really a UK focused car because it is absolutely enormous. It is well beyond what we would call big SUVs, I think, really is. I haven't got the dimensions to hand, but it looks enormous when I saw one on the motorway.
No, it must be quite difficult if you are a Lotus. I mean, it would be nice to hear from some, actually, if they listen to this. I mean, you would presume it must be quite difficult because, you know, you've been used to selling a particular kind of car, and all of a sudden you've now got two new models that are arriving, which are totally different and involve you probably talking to a totally different customer base as well. So,
And 15 years ago, you would have said the same thing about MG. All right, they've gone the other way. They've gone mass market, but you know, they've managed to change. And I don't really see why Lotus can't, to be honest. I think it's a strong enough name.
I suppose it's just the road to get there is going to be interesting for them, isn't it?
Yes. So, yes, those were the accounts. Yes, it made for some pretty interesting reading, I thought, this week, those accounts.
Lovely. Well, I will move us on then to another financial story.
Lovely.
We're getting sort of, this is the FCA and motor finance. I've forgotten the term discretionary, blah, 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 that one, the thing we keep talking about. So the FCA have now, we're kind of getting information slightly piecemeal here, aren't we? Because the FCA moves at a relatively glacial pace because it's an enormous thing. But the FCA have taken the interesting step of issuing a statement to us today. They've warned, well, they have actively warned, they say, motor finance firms to prepare to pay out in the event of, you know, a sort of PPI-ish type reclaim situation happening. So the statement says, we are writing to motor finance firms to remind them they must maintain adequate financial resources at all times. That's the first line of this statement that they've sent to us. So obviously that sounds to me like the wheels are slightly in motion and they know, they feel which way this is going to go. Again, we don't want to talk about this in too much detail because, again, we don't really know what's happening yet. But that's quite a statement to put out to say, okay, look, we're not at that point of the investigation yet, but have you all got some money ready? Because it could go this way. I don't know what you thought of this, Batch.
Well, no, I was a bit surprised to read this week, actually, because, you know, we covered, as did the rest of the media, particularly the financial media, when the FCA announced that they were going to be looking into all of this a couple of months ago now. And I thought that would be it. And I thought we'd hear the outcome of their findings and it would all be a little bit quiet. But obviously the FCA have felt the need to come out and say this and to remind the financial firms and the banks that this is serious and they really are looking into it. And they're not particularly, you do get a whiff of the sense that they're not particularly happy with everybody. You know, they do need to take this seriously. So I think this wasn't the only story of this type this week. There was also the Barclays story, which, and I know, Jack, that you wrote about this, didn't you? So I don't know if you can just sort of dovetail in here with a little bit about the Barclays story, because they're all part of the same thing, aren't they?
Yeah. So basically the FCA investigation was sparked by a finding by somebody else. Hang on. It was the Financial Ombudsman Service. And they ruled against Barclays and I think Lloyds Banking Group as well, and basically saying that they'd missold these finance packages. And that was what sparked this whole thing by the FCA. This week, Barclays have challenged that initial ruling, saying that they don't agree with it. They're very keen to point out that they're not disagreeing with the whole investigation, just the ruling in this case. But yeah, it's very interesting to read, really. And Lloyd's as well, they haven't said if they're going to appeal their ruling, but they've already put aside £450 million to deal with this. So it's going to be big. It's just a case of how big, I think, without wishing to prejudge anything.
Absolutely. And the FCA have also, they also said that some motor finance firms have engaged constructively, but many were struggling to promptly provide the data they need. So I think even there, the FCA is getting slightly frustrated by some of this as well. I'm sure this will rumble on for some time to come, but if you're a finance provider, it's a slightly daunting time, I would imagine, right now. Again, what the other element of this, of course, is where do dealers stand? At the minute, it looks like this is being focused mainly on the finance providers, doesn't it? But only time will tell.
Yes, and I mean, that is a good point because, this story's had a lot of coverage by the national media. Of course, Martin Lewis was one of the first to jump onto this. And, you know, it has sort of been branded the next PPI scandal, isn't it? And as soon as customers hear anything like that and they feel there's the implication they may have been missold something, obviously, and understandably, people get very anxious about this and they want some action immediately, don't they? And I think there is the fear that dealers are going to be getting the heat of this a lot, aren't they? And
because they were at the point of sale, that's the thing, is a bit
yes.
Like,
and in some cases, it is a little bit out of their hands in some instances. I do hasten to add. So I'm sure dealers have been taking a lot of flack for this already, and I think it's only going to continue, isn't it, as we get into the latter stages of this investigation and the FCA come out with their findings and their recommendations.
We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Yeah.
Shall I move on? Yes, please do.
So there was announcement of a acquisition this week, which really took me by surprise, I have to say. And it's Automotive Transformation Group, ATG. I'm sure many people know of ATG. You know, in the past, it was G-Forces and a whole host of other companies. But ATG is going to be taken over by Keyloop, which after the two firms reached a definitive agreement over an acquisition. We don't know how much it's for. It's an undisclosed fee, but it'll see ATG join forces with Keyloop in a move which bosses say will help retailers and OEMs improve the customer experience. I just really wasn't expecting this at all. Of course, ATG and G-Forces in the past have always been a strong supporter of our work here at Car Dealer. And, you know, we only had ATG at the Car Dealer Live conference in last month, didn't we? And Tim Smith, as always, was speaking very eloquently about the need for omnichannel and, the online experience and what have you. And you can only assume, you know, ATG is a very, very experienced and well-run operation and, Keyloop as well. So you can only assume that the coming together of these two companies is going to be a good thing for dealers and OEMs and ultimately customers. But yes, I just wasn't really expecting it at all.
No, I wasn't either. And I think, yes, because we've been having done this for 12 plus years, whatever. How long have you've been here, Batch? 25 years, probably.
Yes, feels like it, yeah.
You know, we were so used to G-Forces, and then it was quite a shock when it became ATG. And this has come relatively shortly after that, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think it must speak to, I mean, we know they're fantastic operators, both G-Forces and ATG. And I think this speaks to the quality of the products and the team that they have, really, doesn't it? Which is an enormous corporation, I suppose, is the word. Have taken an interest and bought them in this way. So yeah, I mean, what this will mean for ATG's customers, I suppose we'll find out shortly. But yes, you'd hope it's all positive, because the more things are incredibly complicated, aren't they, for dealers at the minute? And the more things that can be under one roof rather than talking to 900 different suppliers, you would hope it's a good thing.
Yes, absolutely. So yes, we wish them the best of luck, obviously. So
absolutely. Right. Shall I go for... I'm going to talk about Alfa Romeo.
Oh, okay.
So Alfa Romeo have revealed their first ever EV. Surprisingly, it's their first ever EV, but I suppose it is. Maserati have even got there before Alfa Romeo, haven't they? So their first ever EV is called the Milano, and it's a compact SUV, which is sort of becoming the successor to the Giulietta and the Mito all in one, two cars which died off long ago. But it's in that kind of, what would you call it, the B-segment / C-segment SUV, sort of VW T-Roc-sized, I suppose. So a couple of interesting things about this. One, obviously, it's their first electric car. Jolly nice. Second is that it won't just be electric. They're launching this new car not entirely as an electric car. This seems to be the way that Stellantis does things now, isn't it? It goes, look, here's a new electric car that we've launched. Oh, by the way, you can also have a petrol, because we're not entirely confident that the EV will sell that well. So that's exactly what they've done here as well. I won't go into the various ins and outs of the specification, but I would hazard a guess this is based on the usual Stellantis small SUV, you know, the Avenger and the Peugeot 2000.
It is. Mokka, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's all that. It's got the same engines, roughly the same battery size and so on. They've given it a slightly juicier electric motor in one of these things. You can have it with 243 brake horsepower, which is all right, isn't it, for a small car like that? I don't mean to be a downer. I'm sorry, any Alfa Romeo dealers listening. I don't think it looks all that special. There's been some outpouring of anger about the grill. I quite like the grill, but I do just think it looks like a Renault Captur, this particular thing. Photos are available on our website. But that said, Alfa Romeo desperately, desperately needs some more product, particularly in this sort of area. You know, I mean, what they've just launched, the Tonale, not Toenail, which is a slight size up from this, isn't it? But beyond that, it's all been very quiet over the last few years. They've had the Giulia and they've had the Stelvio, which the Stelvio is a reasonable seller, I think. Giulia being a, you know, Vectra-sized saloon. Vectra-sized, what am I about?
Vectra?
You can compare Alfa Romeo to Vauxhall Vectras now, Sean.
Are you feeling all right?
Look, they're both Stellantis brands now, I can say that. You know, it's not an area of the market that they sell a huge amount of, I would imagine. They're desperate for things like this. Where my concern is, and not to sound like a boring motoring journalist type person, is there enough Alfa Romeo DNA in this particular car? I'm not entirely convinced there is. But I'm sure you'll have something to say about this batch. As an Alfa Romeo aficionado and previous Giulia driver,
what's
your previous place of employment?
I do agree with you. I mean, is there enough Alfa Romeo DNA in it? But what is Alfa Romeo DNA? Because, you know, Alfa Romeo has had so many reinventions over the years that I struggle to sort of pin down what DNA is. I mean, is it the Grand Prix winning days in the 1930s when, you know, is that Alfa Romeo DNA, or is it Alfa Romeo Giulietta of the 60s, or is it the Alfa Spider? I mean, I don't really know. And I think we're all guilty of this. You know, we journalists and people within the industry are saying, yeah, Alfa Romeo is a very passionate brand and it's got all these wonderful attributes. And yes, it does. And it does have a wonderful history. But to the man on the street, I mean, does it really matter? And do they understand what it is? And I think Jaguar has got a similar problem, because, you know, we all recognize the heritage of both of these brands, particularly within motorsport. But Does the person on the street really give a damn about all of that? I don't know. I'd like to think they do, but it is tricky. And Stellantis, on the one hand, it's great that they've got all these brands and they're able to platform share. You know, they're able to develop an electric car platform which can be used for Vauxhall or Lancia or DS or Peugeot Citroën or Alfa Romeo. But trying to work out what each brand stands for and convincingly getting that across to the customer is a very, very tricky thing. I've seen the pictures of the car, and I think, unfortunately, that car is guilty of which many cars suffer from these days, which press photos don't do it justice. And I think it is going to be one of those cars that hopefully will look better in the metal, because I haven't really been that convinced.
It looks slightly better than the Tonale, I have to admit. I think that looks a bit peculiar. But I mean, to their credit as well, they have managed to differentiate all those different cars on the same platform, haven't they? In a way that perhaps even VW Group haven't been quite so successful at. These do, apart from the fact that it's got window switches from a Citroën circa 2003, which they all seem to do now, it doesn't look like necessarily a Peugeot or a Citroën or a DS or a Vauxhall or a Lancia. Or there's a lot of frigging brands, haven't they? Matt, this is your story. What do you reckon?
I agree. It sounds boring, I know, but I don't want Alfa making compact SUVs. I want them making little sports cars to drive around the Amalfi Coast in that'll sell to 10 people. I know this car, they've put four-leaf clovers in the interior, which is a little nod to their heritage. But as you say, it's very much a likeness to all the other cars in the Stellantis lineup.
Well, it has already ruffled a few feathers, this car, because I was reading this morning that the Italian government are a little bit annoyed at Stellantis because... Yes. Of course, this car's called Milano, you know, Milan.
Let me guess, is it made in China?
And it is. It's made in Poland. And the Italian government are coming down on Stellantis saying, look, you cannot call this Milano because it's not built in Italy. And they've got this very strict rule of made in Italy, which we've seen sort of play out with... Parmigiano, you know, like Parmesan. You can only call it Parmesan if it's actually, you know, it is from that area. And we've also seen it played out with Prosecco in the past and all this kind of stuff. So apparently Stellantis are coming under fire from the Italian government saying you cannot call it Milano because it's built in Poland. Now, we haven't reported on this story yet. It's something I read this morning, but it is quite interesting that... The Italians are getting rather hot under the collar for this car, and not particularly for the right reasons.
I'm sure we're all looking forward to the Alfa Romeo Warsaw.
Yes.
Absolutely. Was that my story? Move us on, Batch.
That was yours. I'd like to talk about new cars. I had a chat with Auto Trader this week. Auto Trader's Ian Plummer. It was a really interesting interview. We videoed it as usual, so you can go and watch that on our website. But the main angle for me, which I found to be really interesting, was discounting. And Ian and I chatted, well, Ian spoke at great length about the discounts, the fabulous discounts that are available on new cars at the moment, because, of course, the market has changed from being a pull market to a push market. He is insistent that the market hasn't, we're not at an overheated market yet, because we're still selling, you know, a couple of million, or almost a couple of million cars a year. But discounting by the OEMs is rife. And he's of the view that this is only really going to continue. Of course, it will come as no surprise to know that electric cars have got the biggest price cuts going at the moment, he just thinks it's going to carry on, and particularly with electric cars, until this massive price gap between petrol and diesels and EVs can be sort of squared off a little bit. OEMs and dealers have got no choice but to slash prices to get private buyers behind the wheel, which, as we know, whenever we look at the new car registration figures, the growth in electric cars at the moment is entirely from fleet. Now, I know a lot of people say, ah, yes, but that's an all-encompassing, it's an umbrella term. EV, there is demand for EVs. But if you go by purely what the SMT Go say, private demand is receding, and private buyers simply aren't buying brand new electric cars. So yeah, really interesting chat from me in there, particularly around discounting.
Yeah, not a huge surprise that it's electric. As you were talking there, I wasn't listening to you, but I did go on the Mercedes website just to see what their offers were at this particular point. And to be fair, well, there's discounting across the range, actually. So an A-Class, $3,500 off, but 5.2% APR on finance. If you go to something electric, suddenly it's 0% finance. Mm. And if you're buying an EQE, okay, it's a bigger car, $4,000 off, 0% finance. Enormous amount of money being handed over for these things, really, isn't there?
Mm.
One manufacturer. I mean, we've seen more ridiculous discounts than that, haven't we, being advertised, not necessarily at this exact moment. But it's interesting to see Auto Trader data, which, as you say, says it's gone up quite a bit, the amount of discounting compared to the prior year.
Mm.
I thought it was interesting to say, because this, no one's really said it's now a push market. And Ian said, yes, it is. It's a push market now. That's where we're back. It was always, are we going back to a push market? And, well, we've arrived. We're here. The days of COVID demand are over, aren't they? Not COVID demand, but you know what I mean. COVID restricted supply are now over.
Yeah, I don't think we're quite at the stage of having airfields full of cars. But you know, I do hear stories of there are compounds full of brand new cars, particularly electric ones. So yeah, the market very much is returning to that kind of pre-COVID era. But of course, this time round, before COVID, electric cars obviously were important, but it was very much it wasn't the volume customer that car manufacturers were having to target. Now car manufacturers are having to meet these new legislations. They do have to start forcing these new electric cars down people's throats, and it seems the only way that manufacturers can do that at the moment is by slashing prices, or it's not necessarily slashing prices here. If you talk in their speak, which is the dealer contribution, which, as we all know, quite often it just means just money has just been money off, basically. Yes. Same. Yes.
Okay. Shall I move us on? I shall bring us news of another car subscription service that seems to have disappeared. So this is one called, I can't believe it's actually called this, but it's called Elmo Drive, as in the small red furry Sesame Street creature. So Elmo Drive was a Stellantis-owned car subscription service. It's been going for 5 years. Last accounts show it made a £16.5 million loss in its 2022 to 2023 financial year. And, I mean, to be fair, I sort of saw this coming, because last November it carried out what it called a defleeting exercise to raise money, which basically meant bringing back everyone's cars that they'd subscribed them out to and not really replacing them. So they were really struggling, I think, when they did that back in November. But they've now just disappeared entirely. If you go to their website, there's a very generic-looking error message sort of saying, where it says, Elmo Drive Limited has now been wound down as a business. If you have queries on a previous subscription, please contact blah, 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 blah. And that's it. So it's just disappeared. Another car subscription model that I think we can probably safely say has not worked in the current financial situation, or whether it's to do with customer demand or what. But this joins a whole host of others, hasn't it? This follows Cazoo bought one, I believe, didn't they? Drover.
yeah,
shut down. But then, you know, you never know whether that was a Cazoo related thing or a car subscription related thing. On2 was perhaps the biggest name. They went, of course, didn't they, last year? It's not looking great. I think there's a handful still around, aren't there? Is there one owned by JLR, if I imagine this? There's a source.
There is, yes. Yeah. And just... I was actually reading a press release came through this week, actually, of a Danish company that is eyeing up launching its subscription service in the UK, partnering up with a car retailer, it said. Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, I remember talking a lot about car subscriptions probably about 4 years ago, and saying this was the new thing. This is the new way that people were going to buy their cars. But I think, unfortunately, you know, there's been a cost of living crisis. Well, there still is a cost of living crisis. But I just think the timing has just sort of been a little bit wrong. And when times are hard and budgets are tight, consumer finances are tight, you know, the benefits of car subscriptions sort of don't outweigh the price that you have to pay for them. And you do have to pay for that flexibility of being able to change your car every 3 months or whatever the time period is. Yeah, it's a shame to see a company sort of shutting its doors and what have you. But I don't find it surprising because I think a lot of people are reassessing how they purchase cars and car subscriptions. The benefits of them, I think, are very difficult to understand, I think.
Yeah, I think they're just too expensive. I mean, as you said, benefits don't outweigh it. Most people don't want to change their car every 3 months. And if you're going to get it on a finance, there's no point not going PCP, for example, you know?
Mm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you're sitting here in our ivory tower of having new cars delivered to us to buy, when we're offered things like a 3 month loan, sometimes we kind of think, oh, 3 months, well, that's a bit annoying, isn't it? Because we've only just got used to it. Before, you know, the point of us having these is that we get used to them, we can write about their foibles and they really bed into our lives, don't they? That doesn't happen after 3 months. And I think probably, yeah, as you say, if people are looking for short-term transport like that, they don't really look to these subscription firms. I just think if they have the means to, they'll go and buy a car, or failing that, hire one occasionally. It's just... I don't think it works. I should say, just as an add-on to the end of this, Onto, who I mentioned there, are still trading, I should say. It's just that they are currently in administration.
Okay. Good clarification. Well done.
Was that my story or yours?
That was your story, but I've actually come to the end of my stories because I also had Peter Waddell and the FCA on my list. So, yeah. I've got nothing more to say, actually.
Well, I've got one more to sneak in. Unfortunately, somebody behind me has started doing some building work, so that's going to interrupt me now. I'm just going to finish off a saga that we started last week. I say a saga. It lasted a week. It's the return of Tom Hartley's underwear. So we reported last week, Tom Hartley went to a well-known health farm again, as he put it, and had his... very expensive belt, very expensive trainers, jeans and underwear taken or mislaid or stolen. He said stolen. He's gone back there a week later and they've been handed back to him. So whether I like to think that our coverage, particularly on the podcast, made these items so hot, as I believe the police and the criminals would say, that they became impossible to sell. And they've been returned silently to the health farm, or whether perhaps somebody tidied them away and they've now been rediscovered. We'll never know. But good news, because Tom Hartley is now happy because the monogrammed underpants are back, as are the rest of his clothes. So a happy ending there, I think.
And it clears the good name of Thierry Henry and Thor Hurt. Yeah, who I found out died in 2003. So your accusations, John, last week, scandalous.
I know. Thor Hurt can rest in peace now. And I think listening back to the podcast, I did feel a pang of shame that we brought Thor's name into such libel. Well, not libelous, but
you had an email from her estate, Batch.
Pardon?
You had an email from her estate.
No, but I expected to. Poor old Thora. But anyway, so I'm glad we cleared that up, really, because but also I'm glad that Tom's got his items back. Of course I am. But it was sort of just a little bit of, it was such a brilliant story. And then, oh, they've been found. It was like, oh. we'd swept aside whole DPSs in the double page spreads in the magazine to cover this story at great length. And then on Monday we had, they've been found.
So there were news teams outside the Champneys, you know, trucks. No, not really. But we, you know, we weren't far off dispatching you, Jack.
Never
as
mind.
We normally do. No, we just sent you, we've never sent you to a health spell. We just send you to the, you know, the Crown Court in Swansea or something, don't we?
Oh yes, it's all glamour.
Properly living the life. So before I ask for your verdict, Jack, are there any stories you think we should have talked about this week?
The only one I've got on my list, and shame, give it a shameless plug, is the comments from Cazoo this week. Paul Whitehead has been writing on LinkedIn saying how proud he is of all of Cazoo's achievements. It's got the response you'd expect from dealers. They've accused them of all sorts of things, disrespecting industry peers, all the usual accusations. But I just think it's slightly funny that still, after everything that's gone on at Cazoo, they still insist now we've been successful and we're very proud. I mean, I think Paul Whitehead is very much Alex Chessman's right-hand man, so he's not going to say otherwise, but I think everybody knows that's not true.
The problem is, we all know LinkedIn and what it's like. And unfortunately, if you're going to post anything on LinkedIn, you've got to use that kind of language and tone, haven't you? You can't say, I'm absolutely relieved that I'm seeing the back of this company. I've had a dreadful time. And I can't, you can't say things like that, can you? So you've got to try and put a positive spin on everything. Now, I'm not saying that Mr. Whitehead, you know, was putting a positive spin on stuff, but you do have to sort of say things were brilliant and what have you, don't you? Because that's the LinkedIn culture.
What I would say as well, and that, you know, not to I can't speak to the competence of anyone at Cazoo that set it all up. Obviously, they did an amazing amount of things, you know, as he says, or I'm not sure if this is strictly true, but he says 5 years ago, it wasn't possible to buy a used car entirely online in the UK. And they set out to break the mold and create a new category for buying and selling a used car online. And, you know, they did achieve a lot. And I think their website, I would still say, works really well. I mean, Jack, you are a customer, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Would you say it worked really well?
It did. Actually, on the customer side of things, it's bizarre. See, I know what's going on at Cazoo because I do this job, but if I didn't, you would not have a Scooby-Doo that anything was different. I've not had an email, no contact with them whatsoever, because my car's on PCP, so it goes back to them. And I've not heard a peep out of them to say what happens with it from now. It's very strange.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I've been keeping an eye to see if they stop, you know, they're going to stop selling cars. You would think at some point they will stop buying cars off people as well.
Yeah.
But as far as I've noticed, that hasn't gone away off their website yet. So it's obviously still further down the pipeline they're going to stop doing this. But anyway, what I was going to say is, you know, they have achieved quite a lot, but it's also what helps you achieve these things is enormous amounts of money. I like to think that if you gave a lot of people enormous amount of money from an investment company, they could achieve wonderful things like that as well from a blank sheet of paper. So I think we just have to bear that in mind. And I don't think they really recouped that or were ever going to recoup that investment. Hashtag customer obsessed, as he says on the LinkedIn there. So I'm going to have to ask you, who chose the best stories? Who is your winner?
Well, I'm going to give it to Batch on the basis that he's threatened to give me more work this afternoon. It's Friday.
Yes, yeah,
I was just joshing, Jack. Don't worry.
Oh, in that case, John, well done.
I mean, what was your story of the week, really? It doesn't have to be one that we've...
It was Peter Waddell's pants. Not Peter Waddell. Tom Harley's pants. I don't want to think about Peter Waddell's pants.
Oh, my word. What a way to win.
Disclaimer, we're not aware of any issues to do with Peter Waddell's underwear. As soon as we hear anything,
he doesn't have PW on either leg as well, so it's okay.
Well, he might have. We haven't seen a copy of them for evidence. on that very odd note, thank you, Jack. It's all that's left for me to say is thank you to Jack and Batch, and thank you for listening. He'll be back next week with another episode. Make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. By all means, give us a rating on Spotify or Apple or I don't know, whatever podcast platforms we end up on, probably all of them. If you want to check out the stories I mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.